Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
The Writing Life. Welcome to Virginia Conversations. I'm A. Lily Lee. Today we talk with three Virginia writers, Sherry Reynolds, Catherine Hankla, and Kristen Page Madonia. They join us now. And we begin with Sherry Reynolds. She is the New York Times best-selling author of The Rapture of Canaan, which was an Oprah Book Club selection. She's written six published novels that include A Gracious Plenty, Firefly Cloak, The Sweet In-Between, and just recently she came out with The Homespun Wisdom of Myrtle T. Cribb. She is the Ruth and Perry Morgan Chair of Southern Literature at ODU in Norfolk. Sherry lives in Cape Charles. Hello, Sherry.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. You're coming from your office in Norfolk, aren't you?
That's right. I'm at ODU this morning.
Great to have you with us. And we also have Catherine Hankla. She's the author of 11 books of poetry and fiction, including the novels A Blue Moon in Poor Water and The Land Between. Her most recent publications are Last Exposures, a sequence of poems, and the story collection, Fortune Teller Miracle Fish. Catherine is the Susan Geiger Jackson Professor of Creative Writing at Hollins University, and she lives in Roanoke. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. Kristen Page Madonia is the author of the debut novel Fingerprints of You, published in 2012. Although she initially envisioned it as a book for adults, it was ultimately sold and marketed as a young adult novel. Kristen Page was recently named the 2012 D.H. Lawrence Fellow, and her short fiction has appeared in publications such as Upstreet, New Orleans Review, and American Fiction. She lives in Charlottesville. Great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, May Lily.
Well, Sherry, I'd like to start with you if we could, because here you were writing in the 90s. You came out with your debut novel, Bitterroot Landing. And fast forward to The Rapture of Canaan, which Oprah Winfrey picks up as her book selection. Your life must just have turned around at that point.
It was crazy, yep.
Tell me about that. What happened for you once you became a New York Times bestseller?
Well, for a little while, I was popular, and it was a crazy experience. It was kind of a fairy tale kind of an experience because I was I went from being a bargain bin seller, my books had been remaindered, to being number one on the New York Times bestseller list, and so it was like being on a trampoline and flying high, and then you always have to land, of course. And so the great thing about that was I got readers nationally, internationally. The book was published in 16 countries. I had a lot of people interested in my writing, and I've kept a lot of them, and that's exciting. But obviously I haven't had another book that's hit in that kind of a way. And in the aftermath of that, it took me a little while to get my bearings again and to keep my head clear about my job, which is to be a writer and to tell my stories and to not worry so much about how the world receives them or whether or not they're popular to other people. And so that was a challenge for a while. It's been a long time, so I think I've got it under control now.
Is there sort of a pressure once one of your books has been tapped to...
There was definitely a pressure for me for the next book, but then I just went on with my life, and I went on with my teaching life and with my relationships and my friendships, and I sort of got my head clear again that writing is just one piece of what I do, and that the only person who can determine whether or not I'm doing a good job of that is me, and so I better, you know, grab it by the horns. And so the pressure eased up.
Catherine, does any of this resonate with you in terms of just sticking with the writing?
I just want to say first that, Sherry, you're still popular. You're a wonderful writer, one I've enjoyed reading over the years. And, yeah, sure, I think every writer understands in the long run that if you persevere in the writing, that it is between you and the words, that ultimately anything anybody else says about your work, it may be pleasing, it may be displeasing, but that's not ultimately why you must do it.
You know, I really liked, Sherry, when you sent me an email, and in it you wrote, quote, "I'm especially good at talking about my misses as a writer." The fact is that you do have 6 published novels, but let's talk about the 6 unpublished ones. You seem to be just as proud of those.
Well, you know, I've written a terrible novel between every novel that I've published, and they aren't failures. I don't consider them failures at all. They are the step that takes me to the next story. And so sometimes I've had the experience that I've been working on a book for years. I'm finishing the draft. I'm on page 400, and in walks my narrator, and I go, uh-oh, because that means I have to start over. And it's really easy to get bummed about that, and I do. But then, I have to remind myself that my job is to tell the best story that I can and to find the best narrator for it and the best method for telling it. And so the book that I had to write to have that narrator walk in has done its job perfectly. And so it's about patience, and I think about valuing the process.
All right. Kristen Page, your debut novel, Fingerprints of You, went through some transformations.
Yes. Definitely. This is my first one, so it's all been a learning process for me. Every step is new and exciting and surprising as well. So I think there's something really wonderful about the first time. It's not the first one I've written, but the first one I've sold. So I'm in that process of learning to balance between the writing life and also now the industry life and being a part of the business and balancing that.
Sherry describes, non-success with the novels in between. Would you say that what you wrote before was not that polished yet, or did you feel that it had merit and that it was somehow not resonating?
I mean, I agree with Sherry. They're all stepping stones. I could not have written Fingerprints of You if I had not written this first novel that is, it's in the trunk, it's on in the drawer, whatever you want to call it. But that was the book that taught me how to write books. It also helped me discover a lot about myself in terms of discipline. No one's waiting to read your work. You're going to do it because you have to do it, because you want to do it. And so it was a lot of work and a lot of self-discipline. But it did ultimately lead me to my agent, who's wonderful and stayed with me even though we didn't sell that first book. And during that process, of course I was devastated when everyone's saying no. You get very accustomed to people saying no in this industry. But with that first novel, it was very hard and challenging, and I got in touch with a mentor of mine and just said, nobody's buying this book, and my career's over before it's begun, and what am I going to do? And she said, well, it's not really your job to sell that book. Your job is to write another book. And I think that is so basic. But sometimes you need someone else to tell you and to remind you. And so during that process of being told no by the industry, I turned back to the work and wrote Fingerprints of You. So it all worked out the way it was supposed to, I think.
George Garrett, a wonderful writer, whom Sherry will remember, said something a long time ago in a workshop that I overheard. He reminded everybody in the room that what editors mainly do is reject people.
Mm.
And that went in fast into my gut, and I went, oh, you mean they're not sitting around waiting to read our work and say, yes, yes, we'd love to publish it? No, most of what they do is reject. That's their job.
Right.
And that stuck with me over the years and really made me remember when I am being rejected, when other people are being rejected, that's just a stepping stone. That's just part of the process.
I was talking to a former student just this morning who has a first novel out. It did well, and now he's trying to do the second one, and he feels completely stuck and was asking for advice. And, what I said is you really just have to keep showing up and putting in your hours, putting in your time, and waiting for the story to arrive. And if you do that, it will one day peek out from behind a tree. And when it does, don't grab it. Like, just, smile and wave and wait and let it arrive, because it's so hard. It's so hard to be rejected. It's also hard to feel like you've had a hit and then you have to keep, and you have to do it again. And there's that pressure of, how do I make it to the second novel? How do I make it to the third novel? And a lot of times we want to grab it so fast, but it doesn't work that way.
It's funny, what you say, Sherry, reminds me of the first writing professor that I worked with at James Madison University, which is where I went to school for undergraduate, I worked with Lucy Corin, who is now out at UC Davis, but at the time she was at JMU, and she taught me my first creative writing class. I have a fond memories of that class and her, but I ran into her a couple years later out in California, and I was submitting my short stories and working on a novel and collecting my rejection slips, and I said, well, how does this work? You know, what? I don't understand how I'm supposed to make this happen. And she said to me, you just never go away. And yeah, that was the one thing she said. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, you just keep sending them out, you know, and the editors will see your name over and over, and eventually you'll get that right story. You'll get the right fit. And you just never go away. You keep doing it.
Ladies, can you explain how the process works? Do you write a complete novel and then submit it? Or do you just turn in a synopsis of what you'd like to write?
Oh, no.
No synopsis.
You have to write
no.
the whole thing.
In fiction. For fiction, you write the whole thing.
Edited and all.
And it better be good.
As good as you can make it,
You got to get somebody to edit you, and then you have this final piece that's ready to be submitted?
Right. I work with an agent who is a wonderful editor as well. So she works editorially with me. So I'll write the book and make it as good as I can and then send it to her, and she'll say, oh, this is just wonderful and brilliant, but and she'll send me just pages and pages of notes, and we'll work on it for a number of months before we even think about sending it to publishing houses. So that's how my process has worked.
That seems daunting. You've put all of your blood, sweat, and tears into a book.
With no guarantees, but yeah.
Okay. We had a little discussion before we went on air about introversion and extroversion. The fact remains, whether you are an E or an I on the Myers-Briggs personality inventory, it seems to me that writing is extraordinarily solitary. Is that right, Catherine?
Well, let me think.
Because I'm not picturing either of you at a bar with dancing going on around you.
I think that's why I've tried to do visual art from time to time, because you get so jealous of them. They can sit in a room together and draw. Mm. Okay, how many times as a writer do you get to sit in a room and write with other people? No, it's pretty much a hindrance when other people are around. They're distracting. You have to do it by yourself pretty much.
But there's an incredible community in the writing industry, I would say. I do a lot of my writing.
When you come out of your room.
Right. When you come out of your studio or your closet or wherever it is that you do your work. I've done a lot of writing at conferences and residencies and colonies like VCCA. The Virginia Center for Creative Arts. And places like that, that's where you do spend most of the day by yourself, but then you go to dinner or you go for a hike and you can say, you know, oh my gosh, the worst thing happened to me today on the page, and you can vent some of the problems and talk about these imaginary characters and not sound crazy. You know, you're talking to other writers who understand how stressful it can be if a character is misbehaving or a setting isn't working right for the mood, and I think that those conversations are incredibly important to the process.
What about you, Sherry? You're not showing up at bars and
I'm not fit for human interaction when I'm in a writing season. I'm not. I get so engaged with the work that the characters are really more real to me than the people walking around in the world. And so I write really seasonally. I write very intensely from the time that I finish teaching. I teach full time, and so, you know, mid-May or so through mid-July, early August, and then I don't write for most of the rest of the year because I don't transition very well. I am definitely an introvert. I can put on my extrovert hat. I like it when I like to give readings. I like to teach and be in front of my students, but it drains me. And when I'm writing, I'm so in this other world that I really need to be pretty much on my own, just with the characters.
That makes a lot of sense.
I think that's often true, especially of fiction writers who write lengthy work, that it's hard to keep all that stuff in your head and have any room for anybody else's work.
That's right, yeah.
You know, Catherine, you are a poet as well, and I'm interested to know how writing poetry informs your fiction writing.
I'm not sure that it informs each other, but
here's what I'm alluding
to.
I remember reading something that you said around how when you start focusing on poetry, and that's a platform from which you work, it really directs you when you write in another genre.
I think for me, and the poetry has been central, and that's what I'm talking about. Not sure what you're referring to, but that's what I was. What makes sense to me is that because I started with poetry and it has been my through line as a writer, it's the genre that I go back to. It's a genre that I often work out ideas in first, even if they're not best suited to poems. It's a way of thinking for me. It's more than a genre. So I write a lot of things that will never be published because it's just, as I've said, it's a way of working out thoughts for me. And then some of the things that I want to write about, the germs of things will start up in that mode, and then they might find another form, another genre.
Right. And Sherry, you have another genre that you're working in. You're a playwright.
Well, I was. I wrote a play. Well, one of the things that I did, I wrote this novel, and I sent it off to my editor, and the editor said, this is way too theatrical. Your characters are over the top. You need to start over. And instead of starting over with a new piece, I just decided I would learn how to write a play and put them on stage. And it was a wonderful experience because the first thing that I did was I tried to literally transcribe my novel as a play, and it ran for about, we did a staged reading of it, and it took about 6 hours just to read through it. It was way too long, and so then I had to drop things out of it and, you know, just admit that when you change forms, you change stories. And then once I had been more spare with it, other things were able to rise up. So that was a great experience, but I came to the play because my novel wasn't working. And so, yeah, so I had that one produced. It debuted down in Orlando at the Orlando Repertory Theater, and that was a trip. And I also write poems, but I'm sort of bad at it, but I love to do it, and I hope that one day I'll get better. But yeah, I think it's really good to switch forms and to experiment in things, and I think it's great to write things that you don't feel like you have to be good at or do well. It's very freeing. Whenever I write a poem, I feel terrific. Sometimes I write a chapter and I worry.
When they opened that show, Sherry, did they open with the announcement, you're all here by accident?
They should have, but they didn't, no.
I think it's wonderful, but you wouldn't return to that.
Well, I'm not a good collaborator, but I didn't know it until I wrote a play. At first, we did a staged reading of it down in Orlando, and they wanted to change some of the lines, and it was great that I learned what the actors how they thought that they should deliver their lines. But in fiction, your characters don't talk back. In playwriting, they do. And so it's maybe something that I'll do again later in my life. But right now, that's not how I want to work.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. We're talking with Sherry Reynolds, Catherine Hankla, and Kristen Page Madonia. Next week, the art of lexicography. You'll be intrigued by the new words that are making their way into the dictionary. That's next week. But we'll be back with more in a moment with Virginia Conversations. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Today, our guests are Virginia writers Catherine Hankla, author of Fortune Teller Miracle Fish, released in 2011, Kristen Page Madonia, author of Fingerprints of You, released in 2012, and Sherry Reynolds, author of The Homespun Wisdom of Myrtle T. Cribb, which was released this past October. And Sherry, I'd like to put you on the hot seat, if you don't mind reading an excerpt from your latest book. I love the title, The Homespun Wisdom of Myrtle T. Cribb. Can you share some of her wisdom with us?
Well, maybe I can. I'll try. My character thinks of herself as a spiritual teacher, and so she offers advice to her readers based on her own experiences. And I'm going to read you a really short section where she's addressing her readers. And at this point, she's been planning to have some plastic surgery to make her body more desirable, and that was what was happening at the beginning of the story. And at this point, she's just decided against it, and so this is the advice that she offers to her readers. Your body isn't a topiary garden. There's nothing wrong with one body part being shaped differently than another. If your husband, wife, or otherwise beloved gives you grief about your symmetry, send that person out into the natural world. Look at the trees growing in your yard or neighborhood. Trees don't grow symmetrically. They stretch and branch and sometimes even contort themselves. The only trees and bushes that look perfectly symmetrical are owned by neurotics with hedge trimmers. These people are akin to plastic surgeons, and you'd do well to stay away from them. If trees and plants aren't proof enough, go have a look at the birds. Go sit on your porch and watch the little finches that make nests in your hanging fern and keep you from being able to take it down when it dies. If you can get a finch to stop hopping around long enough, you'll see that the feathers on either side don't match precisely. Watch the cat sitting on the mailbox, hoping to grab the finch right out of that fern. The cat has one black paw when all the rest are tabby, and do you think that cat goes around ruminating and bellyaching about it? The cat knows it's perfect as it is. You are also perfect. So before you go looking for someone to balance your breath, before you wear your hair in a strange configuration to hide your overlarge ears, just remember, you could have bigger problems. You could be a finch with asymmetrical feathers, living in a half-dead fern, stalked by a cat with mismatched paws who won't give a fee-fi-fo-fum about your feathers when he crunches down on your tiny bones. Symmetry is overrated. Think about that before you go lopping off your own meaty tidbits. So that's Miss Myrtle.
Love her already.
Thanks.
By the way, Sherry, you know, again, we're here to assure you that your writing is as strong as ever, despite your self-doubt. A friend told a story of how there was a first date, okay, and a gift was presented on this first date, and guess what that gift was? It was your book, A Gracious
Really?
Plenty. Oh, it was adored, absolutely adored. And in fact, that first date has turned into, well, they're about to get married.
Awesome.
So there you go.
Thank you. Well, you know, I don't have too much self-doubt about my writing. I just don't worry so much anymore about whether it gets published or what the world does with it. I hope that it does and that readers enjoy it. But I guess I'm sort of, I'm feeling kind of old and happy about that and free. So it's not so much of a worry. It's just not minding as much whether or not tying my writing life to my publishing life.
That's great. Kristen Page, Judy Blume has been an advocate of yours, and she writes, Kristen Page Madonia is a remarkable young novelist. Her writing is luminous, her voice original, and the journey she takes us on compelling. From the first page, she pulls the reader into a world of authentic characters. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind giving us a window into your book, Fingerprints of You.
Sure. You'd like me to read?
Yes.
I would love to read. I'll read from the beginning. It's one of my favorite parts because the first sentence never changed. A lot of things changed about the book during the course of writing it. It was about a four-year process between starting it and hitting shelves. But the first sentence never changed. That's probably my favorite in the whole book. So I'll just start at the beginning from Fingerprints of You. My mother got her third tattoo on my 17th birthday, a small navy hummingbird she had inked above her left shoulder blade. And though she said she picked it to mark my flight from childhood, it mostly had to do with her wanting to sleep with Johnny Drinko, the tattoo artist who worked in the shop outside town. Stella, Stella, he said when we entered. He sat in the black plastic chair in the waiting area, flipping through a motorcycle magazine, and he looked up and smiled. Big teeth, freckles, alarmingly cool. Good to see you, he said. He put the magazine down as the bell above our heads dinged when the door closed behind us. He was tan and toned and a little bit sweaty, and he wore a dirty blonde ponytail that hung to his shoulders. His sharp eyes were so blue, I thought of swimming pools and icicles the first time I saw him. My mother told me about Johnny Drinko after he gave her the orange and blue fish on her hip, but I'd expected him to be as unlikable as the other burnout Stella hung around with back then. I had not expected him. So that's the opening of the book and kind of introduces Lemon is the voice that you're hearing, my main character Lemon, who's 17, and at that stage that 17-year-olds often go through when she's starting to push back a little bit against her mom. She's been raised by a single mom in a very non-traditional upbringing. Her mom's an artist and a wanderer, and so they've moved around a lot, and a lot of the book is about her understanding of her mother and her mother's life before she came along. So
you talked about how that first sentence remained unchanged.
Yes.
I remember Barbara Kingsolver saying how crucial that is, that it helps tell us what we need to know about the story we're about to read.
Sure. I mean, for me, the book began with Lemon and Stella, and I was working on another novel at the time, which meant I was doing a lot of daydreaming and people watching and hanging out and trying to finish this other book. And I saw these two women in San Francisco crossing the street, and they immediately became Lemon and Stella to me. And so they were on their way to this tattoo shop, and that's how the book opened. And I wrote them into a short story thinking that was all that they were going to be, and they just haunted me after that. But I was really interested in what kind of mother-daughter relationship would be spending their day at a tattoo parlor and what's going on there, you know. And really the book is not only about Lemon coming of age and figuring out what kind of adult she is going to be. It's also about Stella's journey coming of age, too. So
wonderful. Catherine, I know you have an excerpt with you from Fortune Teller Miracle Fish, which is a collection of stories. However, I want to read a little excerpt from a description of A Blue Moon in Poor Water, which was your first novel. It reads, "This is set in 1968, a pivotal year of national disillusionment coupled with the excitement of the moon race. David Parks loses a coworker in an underground explosion and embarks on a search for justice, caught between the union and the coal company. His daughter Dory pieces together her family story, and what she reveals encompasses not only her father's conflict, but also her older brother's downward spiral." And here a Los Angeles Times book review praised that first novel, saying, "It is Catherine Hankla's gift to take material that could be mean and ugly and mine it for beauty, to depict not alienation, but the cruel and tender binding of family and community members one to another. Her feet are planted firmly in the mountains of Appalachia." That's a nice endorsement of that first novel.
It is, and I have Denise Giardina to thank for that lovely review. Listening to that now, and because that was quite some time ago, I've really stayed with that theme, I think, of community and relationship, and it's running through my latest book of stories very heavily, from intimate relationships to the way those intersect with community. And I think every story is along those lines in some way or other, although tone changes and the characters are quite diverse throughout the collection.
So give us some background on Fortune Teller Miracle Fish and how this came about.
Well, if you Google Fortune Teller Miracle Fish, I don't think my book of stories will be the first thing that comes up. It might be a party favor that is actually just a little piece of cellophane in the shape of a fish, and I wouldn't put too much stock in it, but some people believe that if you put it on your palm, it'll tell you whether or not you're going to be lucky or unlucky in love.
Will you share with us an excerpt?
Yeah, I picked out a snippet from a story titled Elvis in Perspective. And this is a little snippet from A Date Gone Wrong. My character is approaching 40 and looking, therefore, for a husband. She is trying most anything to find one. This story is set in a city very much like Roanoke and revolves around a landmark some of our listeners will recognize, Miniature Graceland. So here's a little snippet. "How he got his clothes off so fast, I'll never know, but he was shaking his booty at the side of my car. Not mooning me, but just like he was dancing. Blinding white backside shaking. And then I saw that Tom wasn't wearing a stitch, and he was going to turn in my direction. He was wearing something, his socks. And he was bending down in that light and slipping on his shoes. Without looking back at me or the car, he ran. I hoisted myself over the stick shift and into the driver's seat and turned the key and instantly taught myself to drive a standard shift. I stalled out a few times but managed to leave the curb. I felt as though I were the criminal. Here I was in a stolen car, bucking along the neighborhood streets in a snowstorm, on the lookout for a naked man. After a while, when I didn't see hide nor hair of Tom, I drove his car home. When I woke up, it was Sunday, but I had to think a minute and remind myself that it wasn't a work day before I fell back to sleep. When I woke up the second time, it was 10 o'clock and the phone was ringing. I pulled the receiver to my ear. "Baby," I heard a voice I'd know anywhere say, "My Lear's fired up for you."
So one of the things about either putting a series of poems together in a book or, as you've done, a series of stories is that, this is something I only learned recently, they can't really be disparate. They have to somehow connect one to another, which seems daunting.
Well, especially if you write stories over so much time as I do. I had to really wait a long time for a collection to gel out of the stories that I'd been writing. And I find that writing stories is a lot like writing poems for me. I cannot sit down and do it like a job. I have to sit down when I really have something to write about and pump out the story in that context of really chasing the story down. And it's different from writing a novel where you have a long idea and you can sit down every day and save yourself some notes and start up again. And that's a wonderful way to be able to stop and go with something. But with stories, at least for me, I really have to feel compelled. And so they don't come all the time. So these stories were published one by one over a long period of time, except for the last several, which came after I knew that the book was going to gel around these stories of relationship. And actually, the last several stories in the book are interrelated in that they share a community context, and a walk-on character in one story will be the main character in another. And I don't really think many readers have noticed that, but it's something that kept me interested as a writer.
We talk a little bit about how emotional growth, spiritual growth, all of that helps in one's writing life. But can a neurotic person be just as equally an effective writer? What do you think, Sherry?
For a little while.
Yeah, for a little while. What do you think, Sherry?
Well, I mean, I think you need it all, right? For me, at least, whenever I'm starting any new project, I need to not be very involved. I need to not be too analytic. I need to be not too thoughtful. I need to just get down what's coming up, what's bubbling up. And so there's a really important place to celebrate the unconscious, really, and to allow that to show up. And then after a while, if you want to share it with anybody besides yourself, if you want it to be fit for a reader, then you're going to need to make yourself more conscious about what it is you're done, what you've done, and see what, when Catherine was talking about how stories gather, you know, at first you may not know what the entire collection is about, but as more and more of them collect, you start to see themes, and then you go, oh, I need to add these pieces in. I need to address these sorts of things. So there's a certain amount that you have to do when you want to when you want it to be to be meaningful to a reader instead of just meaningful to you. And I think all writers have to be neurotic. If you're not a little neurotic, then you'd probably do something more fun than sit by yourself in a room with your characters all the time and try
years,
to figure out lies.
Sherry, for years and years.
What about you, Catherine? How
neurotic am I? People might start calling in on that one. What was the question?
About spiritual growth, emotional growth, and how all of that.
Oh, okay, long face. I do believe that writing is a path and not just a profession. I think it's a calling. I think that it does take a lot out of one spiritually, emotionally, and every other way to persevere in it. It's different from doing something that's like an ego booster shot. And as Sherry explained the process of, okay, they take you up, they take you down. So something has to sustain one, and I don't believe it's the opinions of others.
We have a call from George from Wise County. Go ahead, George.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Good morning.
My remarks are directed to Catherine. What is her last name? I can't
Hankla, H-A-N-K-L-A, Catherine Hankla.
Okay, Hankla. All right, thank you.
She has a website. You all have websites. If we Google you, we'll find Sherry, Kristen Page's, and Catherine's.
Okay, well, I don't have a computer. You're talking to a poor boy here. Okay, I wanted to, she mentioned that writing poetry, I've been attempting poetry for decades now, off and on, and but she said that you can't come at it like a job, and I've noticed that as well, and I read something not too long ago about, I believe it was in Norton, the Beat Readers or something, that it just simply has to come along, and you're more or less part of the process. And I was wondering if she had, any further thoughts on that. I can't sit down. I tried once to make myself write a sonnet a day for 30 days. I think I lasted less than a week.
Probably longer than I would have.
I
George,
admire
thank you
that
so much for your question.
And even though it didn't quite work, I think we do also want to give ourselves self-assignments from time to time to kind of structure what we're doing just in order to make sure that the work does come out of us, because our lives are so busy. You have to make space for it, and that's the main thing. I think that setting aside a space and a time that you can meet your muse probably works better than waiting for inspiration.
And it seems that pushing through any resistance is a good thing, too. Don't let anybody discourage you and say, you're mediocre. But to keep writing, right?
Always.
Well, thank you so much. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. This reminder that past editions of the show can be heard on virginiapublicradio.org, and we will be back with more from our Virginia writers, Sherry Reynolds, author of Rapture of Canaan and her new novel titled The Homespun Wisdom of Myrtle T. Cribb, Catherine Hankla, poet and fiction writer, her latest book of poetry is Last Exposures, a Sequence of Poems, and Kristen Page Madonia, who released the novel Fingerprints of You in 2012. We'll be back to take your calls and to talk some more in just a moment.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. The number to call in is 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. We're talking with three Virginia writers today about the writing life. Catherine Hankla, poet and fiction writer. Sherry Reynolds, novelist, and I'm going to add playwright, Sherry.
Okay.
And Kristen Page Madonia, whose debut novel is Fingerprints of You. You know, we had an interesting comment from George, who's trying to write, and one of the things that came to mind for me is a wonderful book I read called If You Want to Write by Brenda Euland. And it really talks less about writing and more about opening up that creative process and really allowing yourself not to stop, or to say, this isn't good enough, never mind, crumple up the page and never try again. So, Sherry, what are your thoughts? We didn't get to hear you chime in about George's dilemma.
Well, I mean, I think you have to show up to do your writing, but I also think that whenever it's not coming, you need to do something else, go kayak and go dancing, do something, move your body around if your brain doesn't feel like working. But after a while, you have to show back up. And one thing that that I've learned is when I can't write, it's a really good idea for me to read something, and often to read something in a genre that I'm not trying to write in. That can sometimes loosen things up. And I also think that if you want to be, the best thing that you can do if you're writing and you want to get better is make sure that you're giving as much time to reading as you are to writing. I think it was Richard Bausch who said that anytime he met a writer that he thought was better than he was, that he found out that they were also better read. And so we have a responsibility as writers to discern, you know, what's good, what's not so good, why, and to ask questions about why a piece that's working works or why a piece that's successful is successful. And we can take those lessons that we learn through our reading and apply it to our writing.
Catherine, Sherry talks about the other things, the other pursuits, and you're an accomplished artist as well, an actual visual artist. Do you find that your visual art leads into your writing?
Let me back up on accomplished. Let's just say,
That's my opinion. You can't.
Thank you for
that.
I appreciate it. If people enjoy the work, that's wonderful to me. I've always done visual art in one form or another. I started out in photography. Filmmaking was one of my passions at one point, and I've always drawn. And more lately, I've been painting. But I think for me, the balance just shifts over, and I really need to do something that's not words. I need word relief. And so I swim in that sea so much through reading and through teaching and through writing that for me, visual art is a way to get away from that, shut up, and do something with color and with pattern. And I find that it just pulls something different out of me, this other material that for mostly babies like my paintings, I have to say. when I've had my work out at the Sidewalk Art Show, guess who comes up and pulls them up out of the sea and puts their face down on them? It's toddlers. They want their mothers to buy my work for them, and I consider that a great compliment. If it were cheaper, it could be in every nursery in the state.
We have a call from Margaret from Northampton County, North Carolina. Welcome to Virginia.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to let you all know that I have thoroughly enjoyed your show. I am a somewhat of a beginner writer myself, and I have gone through all these things that you all were explaining that I couldn't explain what was going on with me myself. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I could really relate to what was all being said this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And do you have any questions, or did you just want to tell us we're great?
She can do that.
We
love Margaret.
Hi.
What are you working on yourself? What do you enjoy writing?
I do songwriting.
Oh, you know, Margaret,
we caught a little bit of flack
the other day when we had a poet as a guest who said that songwriting isn't poetry, and there were a lot of songwriters who chimed in after that.
Yes. And I think I need to venture out more or less into what you're doing. I think it will allow me to be able to pick up on some of the things that I've been missing.
Wonderful. Well, great. Yes. And we're glad that you tuned in this morning.
Okay.
We have another call from Janine from Norfolk. What is your question or comment?
Hi, my name is Janine Latus. I'm a writer. I know Sherry. And,
hey, Janine.
Hi there. I love hearing your voice. But I wanted to urge people to take advantage of things like the Muse Writing Center down in Norfolk, because getting with a community of writers and critiquing each other's work not only makes you show up to the page every day, but it'll make you a better writer.
Wonderful. Let's flesh that out a little bit more. Sherry, have you attended this workshop?
I know about the Muse workshops, definitely. No, I haven't participated in them. I teach at the writing program at ODU, but the Muse offers shorter term, a 6-week courses and that kind of thing on very specific topics, and it's a wonderful resource for people in the area. And the James River Writers, I think, do something very similar in the Richmond part of the state. But it's true that writers need community, and sometimes you need readers, and you need just sort of to be held accountable. And so it's a wonderful opportunity.
That's great. I want to actually tap into your information, Kristen Page, as
sure.
well. Share with our listeners other places people who are
sure.
burgeoning writers can go.
Yeah, I live in Charlottesville, Virginia, and so I'm lucky because I can easily drive to Richmond and take part in the James River Writers, which is a group that Sherry's mentioned. But we also have Writer House in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is a nonprofit, and it's similar. We have classes and workshops. We also do book launches and free events for the public, readings. And even when I attend an event that is for a genre I don't write or participate in, maybe science fiction or poetry, I always leave the event so inspired. And sometimes I'll learn more from the ones about things I would never think of doing, but, you know, songwriting, for example, which I think is one of the hardest forms to write. But I always leave with good ideas for my own work, and so I think you do need to do your research about what's, you know, easy to get to for you and make the trip to these places, because Virginia just has so many incredible organizations.
And Catherine, if you'll review some other...
In the Roanoke area, I encourage people to come out to the reading series at Kirk Avenue Music Hall on Sunday nights once a month, and also at the Liminal Gallery. These are great places to come and hear people read their work and meet other people who are writing.
And we mentioned Nimrod earlier, too.
Nimrod Hall in Bath County, Virginia offers, we call it Art Camp for Adults. And there are writing weeks and there are art weeks, and you can find this online. It's a rustic old hunting lodge that used to be a camp for kids over there, and we have taken it over. It's a beautiful spot on the Calpaster River.
Something I'd like to shift to is that all of you either currently are teaching creative writing or have taught it. And Catherine, I'd like to start with you, because this is a whole other part of your writing life, is to help nurture budding writers.
It is, and I have been doing it so long that it's definitely as significant as writing to me as working with other people's writing. And as Sherry said, it's hard to do that simultaneously with your own work. So I, too, compartmentalize my writing life into parts of the year when I'm not putting my heart and soul into bringing forth the works of others. But my biggest pleasure is probably just seeing my students succeed, seeing... A student yesterday I was talking to, I said, you know, you've taken this huge step forward this month. Your work is so much better. And then she hung her head and said, I know, I just won a contest. And and I just swelled with joy for her. And so that's a great pleasure. It really is.
What about you? Rewarding. I actually just had a student from Writer House. I've taught at Writer House, who contacted me, and her first story is going to be published this year. And it was something that we worked on together in the workshop, and I was just so proud. You feel like a parent or something to see them succeed in that way, and it is so rewarding. It is challenging, though. You have to be protective of your own writing time, and I also don't write as well or as often when I'm teaching, so you do sort of have to compartmentalize when you're going to do which activity. But I'm always, for me, when I'm teaching, I think I'm probably learning as much as they are, to return to some of those basic texts and remind yourself why setting can be used for mood or all these different things that are very basic, and to have to find the vocabulary to explain it to someone who hasn't been doing it forever is challenging, but it's also a learning experience for me as well. So
I think we always stay beginners as writers.
I think so.
Because you're always starting over. I mean, you finish something, you feel like you've mastered the thing you're working on, and then guess what? You get to start all over.
And every book is so different. I'm working on my fourth book right now, and I feel like I have no idea what I'm doing, which is exciting. I mean, that's part of the...
Yeah, I think you have to tolerate not knowing.
Yes.
Sherry, what about you?
Well, I love helping people find their stories and articulate their stories, and it's been a wonderful part of my life. I'm lucky that that I have my job at ODU, and I'm lucky that I love it as much as I do, because I sure couldn't make a living as a writer. And so it is gratifying. Certainly it's gratifying when a student gets it, and it feels so good when students' stories are when they publish. Lately, one of the new challenges, or one of the things that I've been noticing, is that when students get their first books written and out in the world, they sometimes get hung up in promoting the book and start spending their time on the business end of writing. And the next piece, this doesn't usually happen in the classroom, they're usually finished with their degree or with the class by that point, but the next step is to, I guess, mentoring and saying, you know, you want to really gauge how much time you're putting into the business life and how much time you're putting into the writing life. You don't want to put more time into the business end than you put into the writing end. And these days, publishing has changed so much, and so many publishers expect their writers to really do a lot more in terms of promotion and blogging and do-it-yourself book tours and all that. And so work-life balance issues really start coming up in a new way.
Well, Sherry, you must be doing something right with your students, because you won the Outstanding Faculty Award from the State Council for Higher Education of Virginia. And Catherine, I know you are too, 30 years with Hollins University. Here's something I want to throw out there that it's going to make me seem like the curmudgeon here, but it is a concern of mine. We're now in a generation in which the young people you're teaching are texters. They
not in my class.
Not in your class, but believe me, Catherine, elsewhere. And are learning internet jargon and communicating through email, and I dare say probably not even picking up a book as much. And so what I'm wondering is there a new challenge here to getting students interested, or do you just focus only on the ones who are reading and who are serious about the writing?
I think that some of my students who are texting and blogging and on the internet all the time are very serious about their writing. They're just living in a new world, and we don't quite know. I don't know how this is going to turn out in the long run. But I give everything I've got to every last one of them that walks in the classroom, and try to meet them wherever they are. I don't think that somebody's story is less important, or that they're less dedicated because they're using a different modality or a different, that they have a different mindset than the one that I come from. So there's a kind of a meeting that has to happen. I just give them my one piece. You know, I give them what I can give them to help them with their life, really, not just their writing, but whatever I can offer, and hope that that the rest will fall into place. But I don't let them text in my class either. Mm-mm.
Good for you, Sherry. I'm on that page. I think taking the long view with all of this, as Sherry says, we don't know what all of this means at this point. I mean, technology is a tool. It doesn't define who we are as people. And I think that there's going to be a craving. I already see this for a return to more inwardness, because everybody's life has become so externalized through these means of projecting it.
I would say, too, that these means of communication, texting and Facebook, and it's also opened the door for some more forms and structures in literature. My novel was published as a young adult book, and I didn't know a lot about that genre, and have since read lots and lots of young adult books. And there are entire books for teens that are written in the form of Facebook posts or text messages. And it's just fascinating to see how the form is changing and the kind of experiments that are happening on the page because of these new modes of communication. So I don't think it's necessarily 100% bad or good thing for literature. You hope that it can be used in productive ways as well.
When you have new people coming in, I don't know how much you teach just grad students or just undergrads, but when new, fresh college students are emerging on the scene, do you have to ignore things like grammar and punctuation to get to the content?
No.
Okay. Okay.
I don't. I mean, you have to be able to... Well, we talk in fiction about creating the fictional dream, you know, John Gardner's idea of the fictional dream that the writer creates a vivid and continuous film basically playing for the reader. And any breaks in that will throw the reader out. And, you know, punctuation is a break in the fictional dream, and you got to get that right. I will very often assign Strunk and White's The Elements of Style as the first text in any class and just say, memorize this by the second week of classes. We don't want to, I don't want to be a grammar Nazi. I don't want to have to consider it at all, but in order to understand, and, you know, their good ideas and to appreciate their good images, they need to be well punctuated.
This has been a pleasure. Can you believe we've already run through our hour? I want to give each of you an opportunity to give our listeners your website so they can learn more about your work. Let's start with you, Kristen Page.
Mine is very easy to find. It's KristenPageMadonia.com. And if you look at my website, I also have links to my Twitter and my Facebook talking about all these social media modes. So I am very easy to track down, and I love hearing from readers and writers as well. So certainly get in touch. So it's KristenPageMadonia.com.
You can find me through the Holland University.
You being Catherine Henkel.
I'm just coming to that. Under the English page, look for Catherine Henkel. That's the easiest way to find me.
CATHRYN Henkel. HAKHANKLA. And Sherry Reynolds.
I'm just SherryReynolds.com. Easy to find.
That's so easy. And we look forward to. I want to crack into the homespun wisdom of Myrtle T. Cribb.
I hope you will.
Just out this October. And check out Last Exposure is a Sequence of Poems by Catherine Henkel and Fortune Teller Miracle Fish, also by her, as well as Fingerprints of You from Kristen Page Madonia. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for listening to us here on Virginia Conversations. I'm A. Lily Lee. Have a great week.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.